Water. Today is February 2nd, and we are going to be looking at informational meeting today, specifically starting off with some informational issues on the Umatilla Basin groundwater update. And excuse me, Sandy, could you help me with what you have here? We have Barry Norris from the Water Resource Department, Doug Woodcock, the groundwater section of the Water Resource Department, is that correct? And the director of the department, Phil Ward, will introduce them and, I assume, keep track of them so they say what they're supposed to say.
Of course.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Phil Ward, Director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. With me today is Barry Norris. Barry runs what we call our Technical Services Division, but he's also one of two positions statutorily established in the Water Resources Department. He serves as the State Water Engineer for Oregon. And then next to Barry is Doug Woodcock, who manages our groundwater section. And as I understand it, originally you were going to have some presentation by some folks from the Umatilla Basin about some work they're doing there in Umatilla County to address some of the significant issues facing the groundwater resource there in Umatilla County. I understand they weren't able to be here, so we've been asked to kind of pick up the whole deal this afternoon in terms of this issue. And what we'd like to do, with your indulgence, is talk a little bit generally about the status of the groundwater resource in Oregon, in a general sense, and then how we're managing that resource, and end up by specifically addressing the Umatilla Basin, because that's an area where there are some of these issues are at the proverbial head. So, Mr. Chair, with that introduction, I'd turn it over to Barry Norris.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Norris. I manage the Technical Services Division at the Oregon Water Resources Department. Whenever we talk about groundwater, in order to frame the issue on the use of groundwater, I want to just say say something about surface water in Oregon. This is a map of the state, as you can see, and every area that's shaded beige, which is most of the state with the exception of a little bit on the coast, the Umpqua, the Willamette, and a little bit on the Omnaha over in the northeast corner of the state. Surface water is fully appropriated for live flow in the month of July. This is the month of July, and we allocate surface water on an 80% exceedance basis. So the chances of getting a new water right is not very good during the summer for live flow. That means that it protects existing users and that new supplies have to come from groundwater or storage for new uses, essentially. So that has put a pretty good strain on the groundwater resource in Oregon as a result. Well, additionally, when we talk about the use of groundwater in Oregon, the statutes lay out some pretty specific framework for the appropriation of groundwater rights to appropriate that are appropriated have to be protected. That is, will protect senior users from junior users. When you use groundwater, you make beneficial use of it without wasting it. So if you go in to irrigate a corn, you can use water up to the amount that's needed to irrigate that corn, but if you load it on and it runs off the field, you use more than what's needed, then that's waste, and the water master will ask you to stop doing that. The department's tasked with ensuring that there are adequate and safe supplies for human consumption, that's assured. The groundwater is to be studied and defined, so hence we do groundwater studies to define the limits of the resource. Depletion of groundwater resources is to be controlled, so we don't want an over-appropriation of groundwater aquifer to the point where it's dropping, and eventually disappears. We want to sustain the amount of groundwater that's available for users to protect existing users, to protect our economy. And finally, we have to, the department assures, makes assurance of safe and long-term supply to be implemented through cooperation This is by statute between the Water Resources Commission and local users. So that mandates that we go out and work with local users on a cooperative basis to assure a safe and long-term supply. But ultimately, the commission does have authority to make a final decision in order to fulfill the requirements of the statute. Our management activities at Groundwater in Oregon include we review new applications to assure that we protect existing users, senior users. We protect the resource. We do a large amount of data collection so that we can define the resource and analyze it. We respond to interference complaints between groundwater users and between surface water users and groundwater users. We define well construction standards so that we assure safety and protection of the resource. We do small investigations in the state, and we also do basin-wide investigations in the state. Those basin-wide investigations we typically have done in coordination with the U.S. Geological Survey. Oregon has approached those types of investigations in a unique way. When we cooperate with the USGS, it's a 50-50 match. If we put up a dollar, the USGS puts up a dollar. So we're leveraging the money. But our department also includes some of our groundwater scientists in the study so that we help define how the study is conducted, so that we're assuring that the state of Oregon gets what it needs to do the management activities, and we also thereby create a long-term knowledge base so that once the study's conducted, we don't take that study, put it up on the shelf, and go about our business. We've actually got people that have been involved in the study. They understand the resource better than anybody in the state, and we can implement management activities to fulfill the requirements of the department. So with that, Doug's going to tell you a little bit about our investigations.
Oh, I've got one. Thank you. Yes, for the record, my name is Doug Woodcock. I'm manager of the groundwater hydrology section. Thank you for this opportunity today. Today, to start off with, I'd like to chat a little bit about some studies that we've conducted here in the state, and both large and small investigations. Bit of a pixelated map here, but you can tell that is the state of Oregon. I'd like to talk to you today about some work that we've done in the Deschutes Basin right here as one of our major basin investigations. The Willamette Basin up here. We're working in the Klamath Basin down here. And some of the smaller, those are the larger investigations that have been completed in that are in progress. Our next large basin investigation that we're interested in pursuing is up here in the Umatilla Basin right here, and we'll be talking a bit about that.
Let me just say, too, that those investigations, excuse me, Doug, have been conducted with dollars that have been provided by the legislature. Beginning about three sessions ago, the legislature put a considerable amount of money in our budget where we could cooperate with the USGS and leverage that money on a 50-50 basis. Our upcoming budget has zeroed that account out with the reductions in resources, and I just want to mention that the Umatilla Basin study is going to be dependent on us finding some dollars out there, maybe local dollars, maybe finding some federal partners. So it's not going to happen until that occurs.
As far as smaller investigations, those are conducted on our own dime and by folks in our own office, and those investigations would include a report that was just published last month, the groundwater resources in the Eastern Lost River subbasin, which is right down here in the Klamath County, and some investigations that we conducted over in the coastal areas along the harbor bench and along the Bandon area also. Start with the Deschutes Basin here. The Deschutes Basin was put forth because of just the tremendous population growth that was occurring out there. I think over from 1970 to the year 2000, 2001, population quadrupled out in that area. Surface water had been shut down for a considerable number of years, and so all of this growth was taking place on groundwater. And we really had no quantitative understanding of the groundwater hydrology in the basin, and we had a lot of issues in the basin. So we put together a cooperative groundwater investigation with the U.S. Geological Survey. Just a quick slide here, and apologize for the darkness of this, but this is not the moon. This is the Deschutes Basin, and this is the study area. And what this map is showing us is the estimated stream gains and losses that were determined, that were estimated through our groundwater modeling effort and our field work in the basin. The white, blues, and greens all indicate gaining reaches. In other words, that's where groundwater is discharging to support surface water. The pinks and the reds are indicative of surface water losing to the groundwater resource. And in this map, the gains win. There's a tremendous groundwater contribution to surface water in the Deschutes Basin. And I would point out a couple of features here just real quickly. I suppose this would be the bend area right down here with Tumalo Creek. This is the Deschutes River along here. Tumalo Creek coming in, so this would be Bend here. Sisters would be up in this area with Squaw Creek coming down. This is the Metolius River, Crooked River coming in from the east. Pelton Dam is right up in this area. Madras is right over here. The groundwater study conclusions, virtually all groundwater not consumptively used in the Upper Deschutes Basin discharges to surface water near Pelton Dam. So all of that groundwater has to come out. There are boundaries in the basin that force that groundwater to discharge to surface water. The entire flow of the Deschutes River at Madras is supported by groundwater discharge during summer and fall. So essentially, groundwater is the river in the summer and the fall. And lastly, groundwater and surface water are directly linked, and removal of groundwater will ultimately diminish stream flow. These are the science conclusions from our investigation. Our next study, that was actually run concurrently with the Deschutes study, but started up a couple of years later, was in the Willamette Basin. And this particular basin map shows the physiographic features. And these are the Willamette lowlands right here in the light gray. And that's sandwiched between the Coast Range, the Western Cascades, and the High Cascades. The red areas here show the presence of Columbia River basalt uplands. Columbia River basalts, will speak quite a bit about those because they are present from northeastern Oregon, southeastern Washington, Idaho, all the way down through the Columbia Gorge and actually flowed all the way to the Pacific Ocean, some of them coming down through a gap and coming down into the Salem area here. So these are the southernmost exposures of Columbia River basalt. And these are primary aquifers for agriculture in the Willamette Basin. Primarily vineyards really go after these Columbia River basalt aquifers. They like the soils, they like the uplands. So with that, let's go on. I'll talk you through some of the different... Go ahead.
Can I interrupt you talking about vineyards like those? On the in that Columbia River basin area, there's been quite a significant development of wineries and vineyards on the north side of the river, and not.
I've seen those.
Right, sir.
I've seen those. Yes.
Yeah, and not so much on the south side. Is that in any way tied to the groundwater issue and basalt through there?
I don't think I could answer that for you adequately. I would be speculating. I don't know. Perhaps Director or Barry here could answer that. I'm not sure what the source of water is for those vineyards on the north side.
Well, I know a lot of the source of water is the source of water that the Oregon Water Resource Department has denied to the farmers on the south side of the river that the Department of Ecology in the state of Washington has allowed the farmers on the north side of the river to have. So we're always happy when we have the Water Resource Department in front of us so we can continue to point that out.
I noticed that.
But with that, I'll...
Mr. Chair, may I? Or want me to wait?
Well, let's wait until the director has a chance.
Mr. Shaw, I was just going to say that that I think the establishment of that industry there on the north side of the river had less to do with the water source than kind of the initial corporate group that got established there and really made a tremendous investment, and I think that's drawn additional production there. But certainly in terms of the ability on either side of the river for that kind of product to be grown, I think it's there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'll bet you, though, that the department, if we could get enough of us wise people to give them some direction to allow some nice people up river there to pump some of that water out and grow some grapes, they'd probably go that direction. But there's some nice people in this building that just don't see it the way I do anyway. Thank you.
You're welcome. Please proceed.
This cartoon is a generalized hydrogeologic units map of the Willamette Basin, and what it's showing is it's basically lumped all the different geologic units into just three or four units for ease. And we put together a couple of cross sections through the basin here, AA and BB. AA is over here, and it just shows a slice through the earth. The lowermost unit here are what we call low yield formations. Those would be coast range formations. This would be this area over here on the west. And those would be marine sedimentary rock, sandstones, siltstones, claystones. They just don't provide a very good supply of water. On the eastern side, we have the western cascades, and those would be volcanic rocks. And we've lumped them as one unit, just low yield formation for this diagram. And it underlies the Willamette Basin. On top of that is the Columbia River basalt, and these were basalts that flowed down onto a nice lowland topography at one time. Since then, the area has been tectonically warped, and so it's formed this basin here with the basalts as the uplands, and then it forms this bowl beneath the basin, which is since filled in with a lot of sediments. We have unconsolidated sands, silts, and clays in the basin there for development. The next cross-section down basically just shows that there is no Columbia River basalt down here in the lower part of the Willamette Basin, and that the sediments are much thinner down there. Okay.
Thank you. You know, I should have asked it. I'm looking at your presentation. I don't think you're going back to the Deschutes again. Last summer I had the opportunity to go out there and meet a bunch of nice people here, good crops and stuff. And the Deschutes Basin has tremendous groundwater resources. Up where I live in eastern Multnomah County and northern Clefton, it's got a bunch of nurseries and stuff, and I understand that aquifer is, you know, questionable as far as maintaining what we're doing there. But now the Deschutes, do you see the impacts, the more we go to groundwater, because we have to keep stuff in stream, have you seen that a negative impact in those groundwater resources? I understand it's so large it's almost impossible to measure. Is that true?
In the Deschutes Basin, it is a big pile of sediment out there, mm-hmm. and that sediment is full of groundwater.
Right.
It's got a considerable groundwater resource in it, and it's essentially just that. It's like a bathtub of gravel filled with water. Mm-hmm. That would be an apt way to characterize that. And as a result, the development that we've seen to date out there has not resulted in declines like you were referring to up in your neck of the woods. We do see the water level fluctuate in response to decadal climate variation. Years of high rainfall, we'll see the water level go up, and just the opposite when it's dry. But we've not seen those types of declines like you have up there in Clackamas.
Thank you.
In the low yield area, these are these tan areas that you see. They're typified by low well yields. You know, you'll get a couple of gallons a minute. You might get a few tens of gallons a minute if you strike a lucky one. Low storage capacity, very high overdraft potential. It's very easy to take water, more water out of there than the system can supply, and as a result, you can actually damage the area around the well. Yields decrease over time. We have many occurrences of people calling up and saying, when I drilled my well, it was 7 gallons a minute, and now it's only 3 gallons a minute, or it's only 2 gallons a minute. And they're quite upset, and they want to know who they can take it out on. And it really is a function of the limitation of the resource. Many dry wells, people will drill a couple of wells before they get one that's adequate for their domestic supplies. And along those lines, these wells are really useful for domestic purposes. They're really not up to commercial, industrial, or agricultural uses generally. Sensitive to annual climate changes, one bad year can really reduce water availability in some of these wells. Locally, there can be saline water. This is a result of, these are marine sedimentary rocks, and there may be some older water or picked up minerals along the way. And we have some areas that are locally high in arsenic, and those are typically associated with the Western Cascades over there, generally in the southern part of the valley, in the eastern foothills. Okay. Columbia River Basalt Unit, common water supply problems. First of all, let me give you just a background. These basalt units came in as lava flows, and they're just stacked on top of each other, one on top of another. And these flows are quite dense. And as a result, there's virtually zero water inside the basalt flow, but on the top of the flow margin and the bottom, you have these permeable rubble zones, and those are the water supplies. And so with these stacked aquifers, you actually have deep systems which have no connection to what's going on at the surface, and you have shallow systems which actually respond to rainfall and things like that. So you have differing problems with these units depending upon where you're developed in the section. But some general characteristics is they're very susceptible to widespread well interference. When you turn a well on in the Columbia River basalts, they're generally confined enough, jargon I know, but they're generally pressurized enough that it throws out that interference far and wide, and so we have interference issues between wells in the Columbia River basalts, commonly referred to as CRB. They're subject to overdraft. It's very easy to take water out. It's hard to get water back into the system. They do not readily recharge. The water-bearing zones are not always present. There are boundaries, faults in the area, or the water-bearing zone just may not exist in your particular locale. And they're also subject to saline water problems. And that's where we've got very old groundwater that's traveling along a deep flow path. And some of these Columbia River basalt wells are quite deep, and they're tapping into that deep flow path water. This is an example of a well up in the Silverton area, an area where we just administratively, or I should say our commission administratively, withdrew from any further appropriation. This is a deep Columbia River basalt aquifer that we set a water level recorder on back in 1998, and we're just watching the bottom fall out of this well. It's dropping about 6 feet a year. The bottom of the aquifer is down here at about 500 feet below land surface, so you can see they only have a couple of years left of water supply. And our withdrawing, or the agency's withdrawing of that from any further appropriation, actually allowed Marion County some flexibility to work, and the city of Silverton to work to actually extend some municipal supply out to these people. So it provided a water supply to these people, and hopefully it will sustain the resource for those who are currently in there for a few more years. Basin fill sediment unit. This is all the lowlands right down here, typified by the yellowish and the light.
Mr. Chair, can I ask another question, please? That the last slide, that decline from that well, how typical is that? What are they using that water for, and how typical is
this
that?
Committee Member Schaffler, this particular area is predominantly domestic use only, but it is connected to further down in the basin where folks are using this for agricultural water. This water is supplying crops and nurseries and turf. You name it, and they're using it for that. As far as the decline that we're seeing there, there are actually some fairly large areas in the east of Salem, so in those eastern foothills, that are showing these steep declines. We have some administrative areas out there, the Mount Angel groundwater area, the Staten groundwater limited area, and this area is kind of right in between those, and so there may be some coalescing of these problems. So this is one of our challenges, is to look at the Columbia River basalts in the future as a management, how it is that we're going to pursue management.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The slide before and the one before that, you seem to be talking about, I think you said water that was hard to recharge, that was under pressure. I mean, you make me wonder how long that water's been there and whether it's not, whether or not somehow mining water that doesn't get replaced, just like mining coal that doesn't replace by itself. Can you give us some sense as to how these water supplies recharge if they do, and what the impact of that is on our planning?
This is a good slide, Representative Bernhardt. This is a good slide to get at that question. Thank you for raising that. Where you have these stacked flows in that previous cartoon that showed how that was warped and they're rather standing on end on the margins, that would be the opportunity for recharge to get down into these systems. That would be up in the lowlands where you have these interflow zones between those stacked lavas, where they're actually exposed at land surface or perhaps exposed beneath some gravels that are saturated that would allow some water to get into those basalts.
But it is very slow.
Yes, it is very. It is a very slow phenomena to recharge the deeper system. I don't have a hydrograph to show you this, but the very shallow systems where those water-bearing zones are exposed at land surface, they respond just like this to rainfall events. You just see them go straight up, and then they decay as the water recesses out of the system. So, yes, to get back to your question, that next slide there is, you're actually showing, you know, a term, a mining of the system. We're taking out more water than is actually naturally being recharged, and that's part of the management challenge is to stabilize that. And Barry Norris here will be speaking today about our management options and how it is that we go in and try to stabilize these resources.
So if I could follow up.
So
the long-term solution to this problem is to not take out more water than is recharging in the system, and if you're going to have a sustained use of the resource.
To stabilize, to extend the resource would require to stabilize those water level declines, and to do that would require a reduction in the amount of water.
In the current use.
Down
to the level of the amount that's being recharged into the system.
To stabilize this, it would take that. It's a water balance.
It would equalize.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, it's a water balance to do that. One point that I might make about this is that this is a bad example because we know where the bottom of the aquifer is. Some of those areas, other areas that I was speaking about in east of town here, there's actually more aquifer at depth, so the people have more opportunity to get more water if they need to, and they will thus extend their supply that way. But you're absolutely right. The decline that you're observing there is a result of the amount of water that's being extracted from the system and any climate influence that is imparted on top of that. The basin fill sediments are just loose, consolidated, unconsolidated sand and gravels in the basin, and moderate to high well yields, very high storage capacity, a lower overdraft potential just because of the amount of water in storage. They have more interaction with surface water, and that's an important point because interaction with surface water drives some of our management. If your surface water, Barry pointed out earlier, if the surface water is entirely allocated and somebody wants to use groundwater that's hydraulically connected to surface water, we treat those the same. Otherwise, you're allocating water that belongs to somebody else's water rights. You get high arsenic in some areas, in particular up in the Tualatin Basin, there's some high arsenic areas. And the sands and gravels are thin in some areas, thus limiting the water supply. I mentioned that there was a lower overdraft potential. Here is a hydrograph from the very northern part of the basin, Shampooey Park area, a bit northwest of Woodburn. This is a hydrograph very close to the river, as a matter of fact, and it used to be a flowing artesian well. This is land surface, this zero line, and it used to have about 10 feet of head above the well. And over the years, that's been slowly dropping off. Part of that is due to climate influence. But what's a bit more disturbing here is this increase in the lower late season pumping level, where we're just seeing that each year the water level is getting a little deeper. And now we're at the point where we have actually about 70 or 75 feet of seasonal fluctuation in the summertime. And that becomes important because that shows us we've got a real stress on the system. There's competing resource. And certainly people who have shallow wells are going to be impacted by these deeper water levels in the summertime. In the
thank you.
Excuse me.
Is it possible for that extreme difference in water level to have an effect on the ground structures that also have an effect on your capacity to use the well in the future?
Ground structures in terms of land subsidence?
I'm not sure what I'm asking. I don't even know the right words to use. But I have in my head the idea that the water is actually helping to hold things in place. Right. When the water goes away, then maybe it isn't being held in place anymore.
Committee Member Barnhart, there are lots of instances of land subsidence as a result of water extraction down in California, down in some of the other southwestern states. We have no evidence of that in this area here. Don't know what to tell you beyond that.
So as long as those wells keep refilling in the wintertime, we can do this for a while yet.
Yeah, the subsidence that they may have, that they were experiencing down south, may have been due to some unconfined aquifers, large systems where they're extracting the water, and the system is just kind of, you know, the grains are starting to get closer and closer together as the system compacts. This is a pressurized, confined system. And so the water levels that we were looking at, that was not the water table going up and down. That was not the saturated column. That was the pressure of the system that was rising and falling. But it does represent an extraction of water out of the system.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Before you go on to the human till, I just, while we're on Hydrology 101, I wanted to ask you about aquifer storage recovery.
Sure.
And I know that there's been studies in the past, so maybe you can provide an update. And I did ask the chair if at some point we can have the Water Resources Department come back and give a more in-depth discussion about ASR, because I do think it is a viable option for replenishing some of the wells. We've heard about the fluctuations, and you probably know, because Tom Paul was involved in the water reuse task force that I had, and we did talk a little bit about it, you know, looking at gray water or some type of reused water as a possibility for ASR. So if you have any just short sort of updates you can provide us, and then maybe you can come back and provide us with more on what the department's doing to look into that as a viable option to replenish some of these aquifers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, we have a number of projects going on in the state right now that are under limited license to do artificial recharge and also aquifer storage and recovery. There's two separate administrative processes, but they both amount to the same thing, and that is storing surface water below ground, just like a surface water reservoir, except for storing it underground. Some of them are showing real success. The city of Salem, right here in Salem, is one example. We'd be happy to return back here to the committee at your convenience and provide you with some detail as to how those two processes work, where we have projects, and what's going on with those.
Can I just follow up, comment on that? Thank you. And I would appreciate that at the indulgence of the chair, if that's possible, if we have time on our schedule. The other is because of our, I guess the key for me is thinking about the challenges we have in also locating surface impoundments and the option of using ASR as an alternative for storage, considering the constraints that we have currently and looking for new storage opportunities. So that, I think, would be really helpful for the committee, possibly. Thanks.
The next basin study that we began was the Upper Klamath Basin study area, and I think I want to say that was started in 1998. And the reason this was taken on was because there are so many competing uses like other basins. They're just, with the growth that's occurring, agricultural and population, there are just a lot of competing uses in the Klamath Basin. Surface water supplies are very limited. They are dedicated, many of the surface water supplies are dedicated to threatened and endangered species flows. And so there's a reliance on groundwater and a development of groundwater. And the development of groundwater is from crop irrigation all the way to flow augmentation. So, thanks. Our recent activities down there, we've been very busy in the Klamath Basin. USGS-OWRD cooperative study, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation OWRD demonstration project, where we constructed some wells down there and did some testing to make a demonstration how viable groundwater was as a substitute for surface water down in the basin. We just recently published the Lost River, the East Lost River Subbasin investigation. That was a small subbasin investigation that involved many water right users down there in a surface water groundwater interaction issue. We have a groundwater monitoring network down there that's current, and we have the Bureau of Reclamation pilot water bank. I'd like to spend a few minutes explaining, talking about the water bank, because it's been in the news a lot and it's going to continue to be in the news. In 2003, the Reclamation Institute's water bank, actually I believe it was 2002, 2003 was when they really got moving on this. It is intended to provide water to meet flow requirements for endangered and threatened species while meeting agricultural needs. Essentially, through some biological opinions and biological assessments, the Bureau of Reclamation was told that they needed to allocate a certain amount of their water for flow for these species. That meant that the agricultural users were not going to get their quantity of water. We saw what happened back in 2001 when that happened. So we work with the Bureau of Reclamation to identify sources of water, groundwater sources, as one of the options. So for their water bank sources, they include off-channel storage, land idling, and groundwater substitution. What that means is they are compensated by the Bureau of Reclamation to idle their land, to not farm that year. They also do the same thing with groundwater substitution. Rather than using their surface water allocation, they'll use groundwater. And we work with the Bureau to identify where these areas should be developed, make sure that the people who are pumping groundwater have water rights and everything is being done legal. And then as interference issues arise, which they inevitably do, we work with the Bureau to mediate those, make sure that the people who are being interfered with get some relief by turning off the people who are causing the interference, moving that pumping to somewhere else. The water bank in 2003, they were required to come up with 50,000 acre feet. 2004, they contracted for 75,000 acre feet. 2005, it's 100,000 acre feet. And actually, this goes on a little bit. The original opinions dictated that this was going to be at 100,000 acre feet until 2011. But it turns out that in the next year or two, they will be renegotiating those numbers. And so we didn't carry this any further than beyond 2005. This little slide of the Klamath Basin here was supposed to have about 250 dots on it that show you all the wells that we monitor down there, but for some reason they're not showing up. About 100 of them are monitored by the USGS in the state of California, right below the California line here, and then we monitor about 150 of them up in this portion of the basin. I'd like to focus right in this area, right down here on the state line. Here's the state line right across here, and you can see, or hopefully you can see, that there are a series of dots right along the state line. Those are a series of wells that the state of California drilled for the Tule Lake Irrigation District. This is called the Tule Lake Basin, or sub-basin. And they drilled those wells right along the state line as groundwater substitution, so they could pump groundwater in lieu of surface water, and they could extend their surface water supplies. Well, as though the pumping of those wells has a very dramatic effect on water levels in Oregon. Go ahead. And this is a well that's about a mile and a half north of those irrigation wells right on the California line. And you can see that back in 2000, this well was in pretty close to dynamic equilibrium. It wasn't going down in the summertime. And notice we didn't see a lot of recharge over 2001, but it was very stable overall. The drought of 2001 really hit this place quite hard. There was very little recharge that occurred to the groundwater system, and a lot of people turned from surface water to groundwater. Their surface water supplies were withheld, and so they turned to groundwater pumping, and we saw a dramatic response to the groundwater pumping in here. We see a water level drop of 15 feet or so over the summertime. the state wells along the line there had been constructed, and they turned on also in this area. And so what this hydrograph reflects over the years is the running of those California wells. When they turn on, we see the water level drop. When they turn off, we see the well recover. But you notice that it doesn't get a chance to fully recover before the wells come on again, and so we're just seeing this cyclical drop of water level over time. Well, we can't blame all of the water woes down in the Klamath Basin on California, as much as we'd like to. We have our own problems. This is about 25 miles north of the California line, 25 or 30 miles north, and this is a long-term record. This started back in the mid to late 60s, and this hydrograph just reflects decadal climate change, just this kind of up and down steps with rainfall changes over the years. And then came along 2001, and the water level dropped quite dramatically and has continued to do so as a result of the pumping down there, as a result of the water bank, as a result of the other wells that are pumping as just part of their water rights. Anyway, we have some management issues down there, but we see that there's a resource there that's worth using to help us get through these tough times with these flow needs.
Mr. Chair, just if I could, just before we leave the Klamath. So the issue there, I think the significant issue with the Klamath groundwater pumping is that that's been used to take the pressure off the lake and provide the endangered species needs relative to the lake. So what we're attempting to do is to monitor that use and help manage it over time so we have a sustainable resource. We don't get into a situation where we've used up that groundwater and are not able to have it for generations ahead.
Thank you. Map of the Umatilla Basin, but before we get into the Umatilla Basin, I'd like to take this opportunity to move into some of our groundwater management tools, because we'll have a lot of discussion along that in the Umatilla Basin. So it'd be a good introduction.
Mr. Chair, Barry Norris again with Water Resources Department. Our groundwater management options defined by statute are these five options or administrative processes listed here. We can withdraw waters, as Doug mentioned. We did it one out here by Silverton. Commission can withdraw water from further appropriation. They can temper that withdrawal by saying withdrawn for agricultural use, or they can withdraw it for any future use. It is not retroactive, and it's a very public process. It's an order issued by the commission, but we do hold public hearings, and we collaborate with locals. Another option is a classification of water. That's simply a rulemaking process, and it becomes part of the basin plan. And again, it's a very public process with public hearings, public input. It goes before the commission, and they classify it again for certain types of uses. It is not retroactive. It's only on future uses, again, like a withdrawal. And it might classify only for a certain type of agriculture and domestic use. It might classify for purely domestic use, whatever needs to be done to stabilize the resource. Another option would be a serious water management problem area. This is a law provided by the legislature to the Water Resources Department, enabling the commission to require measuring devices and reporting the amount of water that's used in an area. It does two things. It gets ownership by the locals who are using the water involved by requiring them to measure and report, and it also helps out the taxpayer by putting some of the financial burden for monitoring and measuring onto the people who are using the water in an area. Next, and of course, this management option is always available to the water master who regulates water according to the doctrine of prior appropriation or seniority. Senior users have the right to use water before junior users, so a water master can go out and actually regulate wells, turn off some junior users if he has to in favor of senior users. And then the major ultimate weapon that the state has in managing groundwater is declaration of a critical groundwater area. This is really the only administrative process or remedy available to the commission that can go retroactively on a water user. In other words, the commission can declare by order what the boundaries of a critical area are. And then the commission can go in a rulemaking process and develop
a process as to how that area is to be managed. It can cut back the amount of allocation on an existing user, keep doing that, define what's called a sustained annual yield, or the amount of water that is available each year for use that might completely cut off some junior users in order to achieve stability in the resource. That's a critical groundwater area. You can see on this map the reddish or pinkish areas are critical areas. There are four of them up here in the Umatilla Basin, one over here in the Willamette Basin, and one over here in Malheur County, critical groundwater areas. The yellowish areas are classified areas, rulemaking, the part of the basin plan where we have limited the types of uses that can be allowed. And then we have two withdrawn areas, one up here at Mosier, and then another one over, as Doug mentioned before, by Silverton. Now,
We'll step into the Umatilla Basin here, and this is a close-up of the critical areas that we have. Umatilla Basin, we have, again, another basin with a number of competing uses, competing needs here for the groundwater. And we have existing administrative areas in the area. This spells them out. This would be Stage Gulch, Butter Creek. We have the ordinance area, and we have the Yellow Butte classified area. This is our current observation well network in the basin. We have a couple hundred wells that we monitor in this west end here, not including what we do up here in Walla Walla. And that would be a combination of gravel wells and Columbia River basalt wells. In the geology, we also have Columbia River basalt out here. The area is essentially underlain by Columbia River basalt, and it is also warped, and that warp has allowed the infilling of sediments. So we have gravels occurring here, young gravels, and then we have the Columbia River basalts that underlie that. The alluvial aquifer, this little cartoon, has a number of interesting points about it. It has the water level contours on it that show us to the north, groundwater and the gravels are flowing to the Columbia River. But as you work your way to the south and to the east, all of that groundwater in the alluvium is flowing to the Umatilla River. So groundwater is supporting the Umatilla River flows. That is a challenge for us because we have a lot of users on the Umatilla River that make a call for water, and it requires the department to go out and physically regulate these groundwater users for these senior surface water rights. This particular map shows three areas here where the gravels are particularly coarse. They're a substantial resource there. And what that does, go back just a moment. Essentially, just in summary, it's easy to get water into the system. They readily recharge. It's easy to get water out. But because these areas are broken up like this, we have limited local recharge, a limited aquifer extent, and as a result, it's also susceptible to overdraft. Chair Gibbs.
Excuse me. Go back to your previous chart. You're referring to limited local recharge. Talk to me about that.
The limited local recharge?
Yeah.
Okay. My point was that because we have a limited extent of the very thick portion of gravel there, you have a limited recharge opportunity. You don't get a lot of rainfall out there. And so your recharge options are going to be canal losses.
What about the Echo Meadow project?
And the recharge projects out there. The artificial recharge projects will allow you to recharge those gravels. That's correct.
And when you say limited, somehow I think of that as quantity. You're apparently talking about it more in terms of type. Something of that, but there's a fairly significant amount of water comes down the Umatilla in the winter that basically is flushed on out to the Pacific Ocean rather quickly, and I guess I'm concerned about what a more aggressive program, you know, the effectiveness of a more aggressive program there in using the water in the Umatilla during the winter to flood irrigate the Echo Meadows for the
current and, you know, and then future recharging of that.
Mr. Chair, or Barry Norris again, Water Resources. Those are the types, I think, as you know, those are the types of projects or opportunities that the Groundwater Task Force in the Umatilla Basin is looking at, and that's exactly the type of issue that Representative Dingfelder brought up as far as artificial recharge or aquifer storage and recovery. As the task force continues to work through these issues, they are identifying opportunities and they're looking for the funding and the ability to construct those projects.
Mr. Norris, I'm kind of aware of that. We're supposed to be hearing from the task force, but unfortunately they were not able to be here today for emergency sort of reasons. But this particular project has been underway for at least 8 years now, and has met with substantial opposition, I think, coming out of the state Water Resource Department, or less than enthusiasm maybe would be your way of referring to it.
Mr. Chair, Barry Norris, you're referring to the Echo Meadows project.
Yes, yeah.
Mr. Chair, in my experience and in working with the consultant out there, it hasn't been less than enthusiastic. In fact, I think it's been enthusiastic. We're anxious to see this project move ahead and to try to figure out what the results are going to be and to try to define the results and the good that it's going to be done. We believe that there is going to be some good results. There are going to be some good results out of the project. The issue that we had in the beginning with the project was it's our obligation as Water Resources Department and in managing the water and allocating the water for the study of these types of projects. We issue what's called a limited license first, and after the project is studied and analyzed, then we can go on and permit the project for as long as the project is in place. Our requirements are that we assure ourselves that it's going to be adequately monitored and adequately analyzed so that we can see the results and understand that the results are making beneficial use of the water. And so we had some dialogue back and forth with the consultant about what we thought the types of monitoring should be done and how the analysis and how the project would move forward. And I know that was an issue, but I think we've worked through that issue, to my knowledge, and we issued the limited license. We have reissued the limited license, and then my understanding was that the issue became one of getting some funding from Bonneville Power for the consultant to implement the project.
Representative Shoffer.
Thank you. I don't know if I'm talking about the same project or not, but I was out that way last summer, and there's, in order to keep water in the Umatilla River, they pull water out of the Columbia River and irrigate with that. Is that considered what you all call an artificial recharge?
Mr. No. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that'd be what's called an exchange project for surface
right.
water.
Okay.
Only surface water is involved, and they're not storing it. They're simply exchanging one source of surface water, the Umatilla River, for a different source. They can keep water in the Umatilla and then pull water out of the Columbia when flows get down below certain levels.
Okay, man. Then could you all briefly explain, for the good of this committee member anyway, maybe others, define artificial recharge? And there was another question I had in there too, but anyway, could you do that? And the Echo Meadows project, could you just briefly define the one term and then briefly give me a snapshot of the project that you're all talking about?
Sir, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler.
If the Chair allow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, artificial recharge, and as I said, artificial recharge and aquifer storage and recovery are both the same thing.
Okay.
They're storing water below ground. A consultant will take a look at an area and determine whether or not that area is susceptible to storage below ground. Can you do that without the water, just as soon as you're putting it in the ground, just dissipating out every which way and causing problems in basements or running to surface water or whatever. So, this, for instance, the city of Salem is storing water below ground from the Willamette River. They pump it during the winter, they pump it during, and they treat it, and then they store it below ground. Obviously, one of the issues is water quality. You can't be putting in water that's going to cause water quality problems for the groundwater, but once you get past that issue, it's simply storing it below ground. And you can do some of these projects as much as 10 cents or 15 cents or 20 cents on the dollar as compared to a surface water storage. There just aren't all of the structural issues, environmental issues involved. You just have to find the right geologic setting in order to do that. The Echo Meadows project was conceived by a consultant, a local consultant out in the Umatilla Basin, and the object of that is to short-term store the water in an alluvial area so that it moves out through the aquifer during the summer months and replenishes the surface water supply as well as lowering temperature. That's what the consultant believed would happen, and that's the type. That's why we got into the discussion about the type of monitoring that needed to be done, how much water was going in, how quickly it was moving, what are the temperature changes, where was it discharging to the surface water. We wanted a comprehensive amount of monitoring that project so that we could understand how it was working.
Thank you.
Let's move to the Columbia River basalt aquifers out in the Columbia Basin there, out in Umatilla Basin. This is just a picture of those stacked lava flows, and as I was explaining before, they're just right on top of each other, and so you end up with a series of discrete aquifers, and the deeper the aquifer, the more difficult it is to get recharge down into that system. So in summary, it's hard to get the water in. It's easy to take it out. You can pump large quantities of water out of the Columbia River basalts. There's not a lot of water in storage, and it's very susceptible to overdraft. So that's how we get to our administrative areas in the Umatilla Basin here. These particular areas, we saw that we had a problem, and we took administrative action to try to stabilize the water levels and protect senior users. In here, we have the ordinance critical groundwater area. There's the basalt here, and then the ordinance gravel, which overlies that. Those are two different critical groundwater areas. And the order was adopted in 1976 for those areas. And essentially, they do not impact existing users. We just do not issue any new water rights in that area. And exempt uses are allowed. There is an exemption, an exception to what I said about the not impacting existing users. There's a small area here in the ordinance gravel area which is set up on a sustained annual yield. They get an allocation of 6,000 acre feet per year, and that is the limitation to the allocation. I'll explain more of that in a moment. The other critical areas, Butter Creek, the administrative restrictions were adopted in 1990. This area is carved up into a whole bunch of different sub-areas, and those sub-areas are managed on an allocation, on a sustained annual yield allocation basis. So there's so much water on paper water rights, but there's only so much water that's allocated to each sub-area, and then that's divided up amongst the senior user and then down to the next user and the next user below that. Stage Gulch was adopted in 1991. That also is managed in a sustained annual yield fashion through the sub-areas. And again, that will impact existing users, and exempt uses are allowed within the critical area. The Ella Butte area was the last one. It's just this area right over here. Just right here, and that is a classified area, and that is classified for exempt use only. An example of how we do the allocations: this is the east sub-area of the Butter Creek critical area. Water rights total up to a little over 2,300 acre feet, but the sustained annual yield is set at 720 acre feet. So the senior user gets their quantity of water, and the next senior user would get what's left over until you have users at the lower end which are not getting allocated any water, and they're dry land farming or not farming at all. That represents an allocation of 30% of the water rights for this one sub-area. In the west sub-area, 45,000 acre-feet, sustained annual yield of about 5,600 acre-feet, represents an allocation of 13% of the water rights in this area. This red dot here represents a well in that sub-area. And you can see that there was a dramatic drop-off in the 70s, and this has been stabilizing somewhat as we get into the 90s and more recent years. It's starting to flatten out. But this is very typical of hydrographs out in the basin, out in the critical areas. There were very steep declines, and we're seeing some flattening out. They are still declining. We still need to go in there and take a look at those allocations, but the degree at which they're dropping off has lessened considerably. In the north sub-area of Butter Creek, 2,693 acre-feet, sustained annual yield of 250 acre-feet, that represents an allocation of 9% of the water rights. This area is of interest because we are still seeing declines out there, but it's also right next door to Hermiston. Exempt uses are allowed, and there was quite a furor that came up last year over this business because of the continued exempt use development in there.
What's an exempt use?
I think we're going to kind of wrap up here.
Okay.
Either Harmon can update us on, bring us into play on this when he gets here to explain what the task force has been doing. Or, if necessary, I'll call you back if you're not around, busy working. I know that the director isn't busy. I mean, he's beck and call anytime, so he can come in. But I think, and I do appreciate, it's that I know that the Department of Environmental Quality is sitting back there looking like they're going to feel cheated because they didn't get their full hour, and I'm sure that I don't want to disappoint them or cause anyone to feel like they were too far down on the pecking order to get full fair treatment here. So,
thank you, Chair.
Appreciate very much, and thank you, members of the committee. We're going to, kind of about half change gears, but stay in the same general area. The Department of Environmental Quality has a role to play as far as these groundwater issues are concerned, and we would like to ask them to come up now. I see Holly Schroeder is the administrator of Water Quality Division is here.
This isn't shutting off.
And then it looks like Mitch Wolgemut from Eastern Oregon is also here to address some of the issues that we talked about with Holly the other day. And I'm sorry to have cheated you out of 5 minutes here. My apologies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no apologies necessary. It's a privilege to be here today to talk about the quality side of the groundwater issue. For the record, my name is Holly Schroeder. I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Division at the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is Mitch Wolgemut, who is a water quality manager in our Eastern Region office. I guess what I would like to do with the indulgence of the chair is there were two items on the agenda. One was talking sort of about the groundwater report, and the second was to talk about the trend analysis in the Umatilla Basin. If it's acceptable to the committee, what I'd like to do is reverse those a little bit and provide some background information on groundwater in the state and some of the groundwater quality work that the DEQ is doing, and then we'll turn it over to Mitch, and he's going to talk a little bit more about that trend analysis. Groundwater, and you heard some of this from the Water Resources Department, makes up about 95% of the available freshwater resources. And in Oregon, we have a lot of different uses for groundwater, drinking water, industrial and manufacturing process water, agricultural irrigation, and then providing a base flow into surface water. In Oregon, 70% of citizens are using groundwater for their either their primary or secondary drinking water source, and 90% of rural Oregonians are relying on groundwater for their drinking water. The Oregon's Groundwater Protection Act, passed in 1989, and set a broad goal for Oregon to prevent contamination of Oregon's groundwater resources while striving to conserve and restore the resource to maintain the high quality of Oregon's groundwater resource for present and future uses. We have a lot of programs that we work with to protect groundwater. We conduct some statewide programs to identify and characterize groundwater. We establish programs to prevent degradation, as well as we take action when once there is contamination that has occurred. I just was going to run through those programs real briefly. First and foremost, actually, are the programs that I do not administer. Those are the programs from our land quality program, land quality division. Those programs are designed to reduce contamination to land so that essentially doesn't seep into groundwater. It includes our underground storage tank program, our solid waste landfill permitting program, our cleanup program. All of those are integral parts of the agency's overall approach to protecting groundwater. But from the Water Quality Division, we also have a number of programs that we are designed to protect groundwater. We require groundwater protection plans from the point sources that we regulate, that we provide permits to, such as municipal wastewater treatment plants. We regulate the injection of wastewater, so the cleaned up water from those plants that might go into an underground injection well. We regulate those to make sure that those are going to not impair groundwater quality. We have an on-site septic system program where we or a variety of counties around the state implement the permitting programs for on-site septic systems so that those do not cause groundwater contamination. We also have a partnership.
Excuse me. In relationship to septic systems, I'm hearing some concern about the number of septic systems, the type of systems that are basically okayed by the department, and that there's some new systems out there that are perhaps more efficient and less expensive and so forth that we haven't been able to get into the mix yet. This question's a little unfair.
No, that's okay. Mr. Chair, actually, I can speak to that, and I'll speak a little bit to it in two ways. One is I'm going to talk a little bit about the Lapine demonstration project where we've tested a number of those systems, and I'm going to speak to that briefly. And it's been a very important study, part of a national demonstration project that we've been participating in for several years. But in a more general sense, to respond to your question, we actually have just completed a substantial revision to our on-site regulations that facilitates exactly what you're talking about. It allows what we in the rule define as an alternative treatment technology to be installed through a much more streamlined permitting process than before the rule changes. We used to have to permit a lot of these systems under a state water pollution control facility permit, which was an expensive permit. We had a certain set of monitoring requirements, and it was a pretty for a homeowner to sign on to one of those permits was an investment, both financially and emotionally, perhaps. What we've done through the rule revisions is we streamlined those so that these new systems can be permitted under a construction and installation permit, which would be either administered by DEQ or by the county agent in those counties where they are the administrating body for those permits. Those rule changes were adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission in December, and they go into effect the majority of those rules go into effect on March 1. So we think that is going to significantly increase the number of these new systems that can be implemented within the state, and we think that's a tremendous step forward.
Thank you very much for that.
Sure.
That update.
Before I get into the sort of our groundwater management areas, the other program that we have is our source water protection program, which is an integral part of our partnership with the Department of Human Services Health Division drinking water program, where we work to look at, to help them meet the drinking water standards by looking at the intake area for drinking water intakes, for drinking water sources, and we make sure that we identify potential threats to that and work to reduce those threats. So that's a partnership program that we have with DHS. So, and then the final tool that we have, which is where I'm going to spend a little bit more of our time, and Mitch will talk to as well, is the what we call the groundwater management area, which is in some ways analogous to the critical groundwater management area that Water Resources, in terms of a tool. We designate an area as a groundwater management area when we see elevated pollution levels in the groundwater. And we currently have three of those areas in the state, and I was going to basically take you on a little mini tour of the state to talk about each of those areas. The first one is in the Southern Willamette Valley, and that's one of the fastest growing areas in the state, and groundwater provides most of the drinking water in that area. We've been studying this area for some time, and we've really seen that beginning in the 90s and then some additional studies done in 2000 and then repeated in 2002, that there's elevated nitrate levels in this area. And we've been working with local governments and agencies and a lot of the local interests there to get additional information about it and try to determine exactly the causes and the nature and extent of the problem there. So nitrates are the pollutant of concern there, and under the Groundwater Act, we are able to declare a groundwater management area, or we call it a GWAMA, not to be confused with an iguana. But we can identify a groundwater management area when nitrate levels reach a certain level. And we saw that pretty pervasively down in the Southern Willamette Valley, and so we declared just last year a groundwater management area for part of that area. Nitrates are of concern, and you'll see in all of these areas nitrates are an area of concern. It's because it can cause some blood disease. Basically, nitrogen will replace oxygen in the blood and results in some health problems, including blue baby syndrome.
Could you help me a little bit with what causes the increase in the nitrate levels?
Sure. I think,
some of the causes.
Mr. Chair, some of them is, you know, it's nutrient loading. It can come from septic systems. It can come from the use of pesticides or herbicides, other types of, loading of nutrients onto the land can seep into the groundwater. And Mitch, can you fertilizer? That would be what I was looking for. Thank you. So it would be the increased loading of fertilizer can seep into the ground and cause increased nitrogen levels.
Did I hear a question over there? Was it just?
Mr. Chair, actually, I do have one. Maybe you read my mind.
Well, it seemed to me it had been quite a while, too.
thank you. So we're not forgetting that, so we're here. You know, we have this fee bill here to help survey the water and maybe money to go out and see if there's anything, you know, wrong with it. Is this the kind of stuff it would detect if they did these surveys?
Yeah.
Is this the kind of thing that those surveys would detect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shuffler, I'm not familiar with the details of the fee bill. I believe that is not for their the drinking water treatment plants or
sanitary surveys.
It's a part of the Clean Water Act, and the federal government is requiring more testing of wells. The Department of Health came to us 2 years ago, and there was significant FTE involved in being able to do what they needed to do, and there's something like a two-for-one match money with the feds on this. We had them go to a task force and come back with a recommendation for this legislative session. And many of our members are somewhat gun-shy and felt they got bit on anything that sounded like raising taxes, and this has what would be perhaps referred to as a fee bill or a fee with it, and so there's some concern. I think the bill is House Bill 2171. The staff has just brought it in front of me. Is that correct?
I guess my question is, Mr. Chair, then, when you detect these, you know, these blue babies, do you have to, does somebody have to have that happen before you all realize it's going on, or how do you find out this is going on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, there's a variety of monitoring sources that we use. We, and perhaps this is the connection with Department of Human Services, is they do a lot of testing of drinking water wells, and so that is one source of data that we use. There's other sorts. We do our own groundwater monitoring around the state. So we do have it's not a super extensive monitoring network, but we do some groundwater monitoring. We do these isolated studies. In addition, when people have a private well, which is not usually part of the system that DHS oversees, when there's a real estate transaction, they often have to do some testing of their well, and so we can get some nitrogen information at that point, and we collate some of that information as well. So there's a variety of sources that we try to do the testing of the groundwater to detect the potential problem rather than seeing the incidence of the disease.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up on that?
Follow up.
Question
or comment?
Well, it's a comment. It's a comment, and it more of just an observation. And just to follow up on something Holly said, because the bottom line is that there's no requirement for individual well owners to test their water until there's a transaction. So if you're living in your house for 40 years, there's no requirement, and nobody's going to come in and test your water. And that's just part of our, you know, how we regulate drinking water in the state for individual well owners. So just, and if you look in the document that we just got, 400,000 Oregonians get their drinking water from individual home water supplies. So that's a good fraction of the state's population that has drinking water sources that don't get tested on a regular basis. So it's just an observation I want to make sure is not lost on some of my colleagues there.
I'll continue. So after we declare a groundwater management area, as we did in the Southern Willamette Valley, it very much works in a partnership with a lot of the local stakeholders. We form an advisory committee in order to come up with an action plan. And we're very much in the early stages of that in the Southern Willamette Valley. We're working with the Lane Council of Governments, and we're doing a source water assessment to look at the drinking water sources in the area and are determining some of the long-term actions. We also partner up with the universities when we can, and Oregon State has done several classes down there that goes to that universe of people that Representative Dingfelder was just speaking of, who have their own wells. They do some they call it rural living basics classes that help them know how to manage their well so that they can help reduce some of the potential contamination to their wells. And so that's something that it also includes some free nitrate screening. So those are some of the types of things that we've started down there, and we're still developing the action plan because, again, we just declared this groundwater management area last year. With that, I was going to move across the mountains over into the Lapine area. This is not a groundwater management area, but it is a national demonstration project where we are working, and again, we have some concerns about nitrate levels. The Lapine area has a very shallow water table, and there's a lot of population growth going on there, and there's a number of lots that are identified there that could be served by septic systems that are vacant, and so there's a lot of potential to and interest in developing those lots. However, with the elevated nitrate levels and the very shallow the very shallow aquifer that is also used as a drinking water source, you can see that we sort of have a recipe for conflict. And so as a result of concerns about that, in 1999 we moved into the part of a national demonstration project which is a $5.5 million effort to identify some septic systems and look at the effect of different septic systems and what they do in terms of levels of nitrogen in groundwater. We are field testing a variety of the systems. These are some of the systems that Chair Jensen was speaking of, and evaluating the performance of their technologies and how they remove nitrate, and how also looking at how do we maintain those systems, because they're not your conventional or historically used septic system where you sort of put the box in the ground and you leave it alone. These are active waste, sort of small box, active wastewater treatment systems that do require some maintenance, and so we've been exploring what type of maintenance requirements are needed in order to really ensure that you're getting the nitrate reduction. We're working with Deschutes County very actively on this. We have a monitoring network in the area of over 100 wells.
Thanks, Hoffler.
Thank you. You know, this much potential future development, why aren't they looking at a wastewater treatment plant rather than putting in thousands of septic systems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I would suggest at this point that they are looking at probably a combination, or those types of discussions are actively going on in the area. What we were trying to do as part of this national demonstration project is identify what systems could be used that would help contribute to a reduction in the nitrate loading, and so that they have options at their disposal. And actually, this is a project that is going to be actually wrapping up at the end of this biennium. So we are sort of on the final phase of looking at a lot of the data, doing a lot of the final analysis and conclusions of that. And from that point, we work with Deschutes County to determine how they want to proceed. And do they want to hook a certain number of these lots into a more conventional wastewater treatment system? Are certain ones of them more slated to need this type of alternative treatment technology? I think all of that range of possibilities is on the table, but I will also say that there are certain strong opinions about which path is preferable among some of the local stakeholders there.
Just briefly, I'm sure people don't want to spend any money, but I can assure you I don't want to live in a house where the water level, the aquifer, is 2 feet below the ground and my neighbor's septic tank is 6 feet below that. I would have a pretty strong opinion about that myself, but God bless them. I wish them well. Thank you.
Well,
if
I could, Mr. Chair,
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is a problem that has been existing in my district for a long time, and we're now getting to some very expensive wastewater treatment programs in order to deal with the concentration of septic systems. So I think your question is very well placed as we talk about planning in the future. Maybe one of the things we need to be talking about, perhaps, Mr. Chair, is the extent to which the long-term planning requires some consideration of the issue that Representative Schaffler has raised. Once we get to a certain planned concentration of septic systems, perhaps a better system would be a better idea would be a collection system and a real treatment plant.
Perhaps a little off target right here, and deserving topic that maybe we can revisit someplace along the line if we could.
Certainly. We'll move on. I think I covered most of the key points on the Lapine project in response to questions. So we also have a groundwater management area over in Malheur County, declared in 1989, again because of nitrate levels. And there's 115,000 acre portion of northern Malheur County that is covered by this groundwater management area. It's predominantly irrigated agriculture land use in the area. We did see some pesticide issues and of concern, and that is fertilizer and chemical application practices are believed to be the main source of contamination. We're testing wells out there, about 37 a month, and analyzing them for nitrates and for pesticides, and we are sort of evaluating changes in the groundwater over time. I mean, that's really, this is a, you know, a 1989 declared, so in contrast to the Southern Willamette Valley one, this is one we've been working on for some time. We're working with a bunch of other agencies out there. I think there's nine agencies and organizations, and the Soil and Water Conservation District is the lead agency out there. We have, there's an action plan that we are following there that was adopted in late 1991, and it really is looking at a bunch of voluntary actions in terms of best management practices, and is gauging, and we're doing the monitoring in order to gauge success of that, and we are continuing to implement that action plan on a voluntary basis. In December of 2003, we sort of did a report to describe some of the implementation of best management practices through the 90s. We looking at some of the nitrate levels and some trends on that, and evaluating the action plan. And based on that that report, the Groundwater Management Committee in that area has concluded that we're making progress, and that we can continue the voluntary nature of the action plan. It's going to take a long time for groundwater to recover, groundwater quality to return to levels below the levels of concern that we have, but we're just continuing to work with the committee out there, work on implementation of the best management practices, and in December we will be doing a more comprehensive nitrate trend analysis as recommended by the action plan. And then the final area that I was going to move into here is the Umatilla, where we also have a groundwater management area. Again, the Umatilla Basin relies on groundwater for private and public drinking water, irrigation water, and other uses, and it provides about 95% of drinking water is coming from groundwater in that area.
Can I interrupt you just a half a second?
Mm-hmm.
Could you relate the location of this to the maps that the Water Resource Department was using on the Umatilla Basin when they were here?
Mr. Chair, probably in interest of time and to give you plenty of time, I think what I would like to do is turn it over to Mitch, and if you can sort of describe the boundaries of the Umatilla, I think that would probably be most expedient.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Sure. Chair Jensen, committee members, for your time this afternoon, as Holly said, my name is Mitch Walgamott, and I'm the water manager in the Pendleton office. In answer to your question about the boundaries, the map that was up there that showed the critical groundwater areas is largely coincident with the groundwater management area. They're not exactly, but they're similar. They do cover much the same area when you put...
Generally is the same...
Correct.
Piece of real estate.
It's yes. the lower part of the Umatilla Basin, covering the what would that be, the north end of Umatilla County and part of Morrow County.
Yes. Actually, parts of Morrow County runs all the way to Boardman, doesn't it?
Correct.
And along the I-84 corridor, generally.
Correct.
So, Mr. Chair, just as a setup, we have had the Groundwater Management Committee has been working under an action plan since the late 90s, and continuing to work on best management practices, very similar to a lot of the activities in the MAU here that I referred to. One of the things that was an action under that, an activity under that action plan, was to do a trend analysis of nitrate, in particular with some of the food processing facilities that we permit out there, and I believe Mitch was going to speak to that study in a little more detail.
Thank you for your time today. I'm here to basically to provide a little more information specific to the water quality trend analysis that the DEQ recently completed, that is related specifically to the food processor land application sites that are within the Umatilla, the Lower Umatilla Basin groundwater management area. But before I actually talk about the results of that trend analysis, I think it's important to recall that the groundwater management area, as Holly alluded to, it was established some time ago. It was in 1919. Is that what I said? 1990. It wasn't quite that long ago. In 1990, a committee was formed at that time, made up of local residents and stakeholders, as well as representatives from the agencies that were involved, those being primarily DEQ, the Department of Agriculture, both Umatilla County and Morrow County. But that committee then developed, and they spent several years doing it, developed an action plan that identified the measures that would be encouraged or put in place to try to address the nitrate problems in the lower Umatilla Basin. And they felt that the best approach to doing that and the most flexible approach would be a voluntary kind of an approach that encouraged implementation of voluntary measures that would reduce the nitrate without creating any new regulation. But it has to be understood, and that was done with the understanding that some of the sources in the area already were regulated to some extent. So that plan was finally completed in 1997, and the implementation began at that time. There were five source categories that were contributing to the nitrate problems in the area, those being irrigated agriculture, confined animal feeding operations, septic systems were implicated, and the food processor operations that land applied their wastewater, and finally the Umatilla Chemical Depot washout lagoons, which was kind of a past practice thing that contributed quite a bit of nitrogen. As I said, the action plan identified activities and practices to be implemented for each of the categories, and it also identified a schedule and a process for evaluating progress. And for most of the categories, the source categories that I mentioned, that way of evaluating progress had mostly to do with tracking the implementation of the practices. And any kind of quantitative evaluation of the groundwater nitrate concentrations and trends doesn't occur for those sources until the end of the planning period, which was 12 years out. So that would make it occurring in 2009, or after the data from 2009 is available. Excuse me. For the food processors, the land apply wastewater, the evaluation period and process was a little bit different in that quantitative trending analysis was to be done every 4 years. The first one actually being, the first four-year period being ending in 2001, and then there's a lag because it takes a while before all the data is available and then you have to do the analysis. But we just completed that first stage of analysis for the first four-year period and just published that last December. And then we will do that same kind of trending for the food processors would be done again each 4 years. So now we're already talking about at the end of this calendar year, 2005, gathering all of the data that's available through that year and doing another trend analysis. One of the reasons that the food processors could be quantitatively evaluated in that shorter time frame is that there's much more site-specific data available about the groundwater related to those sites. And the reason for that is that the food processors are, in fact, already regulated sources. In order to land apply their wastewater, they have to have a water pollution control facilities permit from DEQ, and that permit not only limits the amount of nitrogen as well as in some cases the amount of water that they can apply, but it also requires them to do groundwater monitoring. So they have to install monitoring wells, they collect samples, they have them analyzed, and they submit data to us. And this trend analysis that some of you may have seen, that was done using the data that the food processors themselves collected.
Is that a fox in a hen house?
I suppose, you, Chair Jensen, that you could look at it that way. However, the way that the permit system is set up, they are required to collect. First of all, they work with us to set up a monitoring system that we agree to. They do put in the wells themselves and collect the information, but they have to have it analyzed by reputable labs and then submit the data. So I think it works pretty well. When this first trend analysis was completed in December 2004, DEQ distributed the report to interested parties, and copies of that report are available on request. It's also available for download off of our website. And the nice thing about that is you can download parts of it. It's actually quite thick and has a whole lot of graphics, so it'll tie up your modem for a very long time if you try to download the whole thing. But you can download the piece that you're interested in. The report looks at the groundwater quality trends for each of six facilities, food processing facilities that land apply in the groundwater management area. So it looks at trends specific to each, to the land that each facility is applying water to. And those facilities are the Port of Morrow, Lamb Weston, which is now ConAgra Foods, Simplot, Hermiston Foods, A.E. Staley, and Snack Corps. The details of those, of the results of that trend analysis, are in the report, and it, as I said, is quite large and very detailed. And for the sake of brevity, I'm going to just very greatly summarize the bottom line of the trend analysis report. Nitrate trends were assessed for 113 wells associated with those food processor land application sites. So it's a fairly large number of wells. 72 of those wells, or 64% of them, had increasing nitrate trends. So the nitrate concentrations appeared to be going up over the period of time that the trend analysis was done. 8 wells, or 7%, had decreasing trends, and the remaining 33 wells, or 30%, were either flat or they had insignificant trends one way or the other. So clearly most of the wells at most of the sites actually had increasing nitrate trends when we would have hoped to be seeing decreasing trends at this point. But this should not be taken as evidence that the plan isn't working. The trend analysis by itself doesn't tell us what the cause of that increasing trend is. It's important to remember that this is an analysis of the trends after just the first 4 years of implementation of the action plan for the groundwater management area. Some of these sites have data that's going back as much as 14 years. Some of these sites have been in use much longer than that. So the current increasing trend may not be the result of the current operations of the facility. Other factors that might be influencing the nitrate concentrations include past activities at the site, activities off-site or near the site, both past and present activities, groundwater interactions under the site. It's unfortunate that once the groundwater has become contaminated and the soils above that groundwater have become loaded with nitrogen, it can take many years for the nitrogen to move through the system and for the concentrations to decrease even after the nitrate or the nitrogen loadings are under control.
Is there anything you can do in that to reduce the loading from the soil?
Well, we believe we are, Representative Chair Jensen, we believe we are reducing the nitrogen loadings, and that's why we were perhaps initially surprised that we saw an increasing trend, because certainly, as I'm going to come to, certainly the food processing land application sites, which, remember, that's specifically what we're talking about and not any of the other sources here, they clearly have reduced nitrogen loading.
I'm talking about in cropping the land.
Is there any cropping you can do to help lower that?
You mean to take it up with crops?
Yeah.
Yes. Chair Johnson, that is exactly what is done in most cases. They are using the growing of crops to take up the nitrogen that is land applied so that they're actually beneficially using those nutrients rather than having them go into either surface or groundwater. And there, it is in fact possible to use some crops. Wheat is often used to mine nitrogen that has already been loaded in the ground from the past and perhaps has gotten even down into the ground quite a ways, because wheat will send roots down quite a ways, as will some other crops. So, in conclusion, the trend report says that even though the Lower Umatilla Basin Groundwater Management Area Action Plan promotes a voluntary approach, the food processors, as I pointed out before, are already regulated sources, and food processing operations generate very large volumes of nutrient-rich wastewater that must be either used or disposed of. So using it for crop production is one of the good uses. And as I said, it requires a WPCF permit for that land application prior to the full implementation of the department's permit program. These facilities were commonly irrigating large amounts of wastewater on relatively small areas and doing it during all seasons of the year, and that did in fact result in application of nitrogen and sometimes application of water at rates that far exceeded what the crops were capable of using. Today, through both the department's permit program and frankly through the cooperation and innovation of the food processors themselves, there has been quite a bit done already in terms of adding wastewater storage facilities, having better irrigation scheduling, bringing additional land into the system so that they can spread that water out over larger areas, so that the nitrogen loading rates have in fact been reduced on these sites, as a general statement. So it's no longer common for the nitrogen loads to exceed the Oregon State University Fertilizer Guide specified nitrogen application rates for the specific crops being raised. The trend report concludes by recommending that the food processors and DEQ continue to pursue funding to better document the effects of the dust management practices that are being implemented and to encourage continued and expanded implementation of those practices. It suggests that we should complete the next action plan required trend analysis after the 2005 data is in, and then we'll be able to see how that trend compares with the one that we've just seen. And we should remember that while most of the wells did show increasing nitrate trends, there were some that showed decreasing trends. And so the report recommends that we and the food processors work together to identify what combination of factors caused the wells that were decreasing to be decreasing, and then we can hopefully promote those combination of practices at other sites and hopefully then see more decreasing trends as we go along with the implementation of the action plan.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chalk.
Yeah, I was reading ahead and I wanted to ask you, you don't mention it here, but do you want to speculate on any specific thing that really sticks out to you where these levels have decreased that you think, want to make a prediction on what you think might be bringing that down? And the second part is up I-5 here, there's some packing plants and they irrigate the property out there and they let a rancher bring his cattle or her cattle out there, and I don't know, they charge them by the pound or something. But when they irrigate that, do you think that is artificially driving up the nitrate level on that property, or you think that grass that grows is soaking that nitrate up? Are they having a negative impact on that water? On the ground surface water and level nitrate there on that property? I'm just asking you to speculate, so forgive me on two things.
Let me respond to that. So, part of the concern here is that there are those who hypothesize that this is what's taking place in the Umatilla Basin,
mm-hmm.
That this accumulation of, this, and not perhaps paying as much attention to detail as they're supposed to be done. I'm not sure where that is, but if you're going to take water that's full of nitrate and put it on land out there, it stands to reason that some levels are going to go up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you're asking. I don't know about the local plants, and I,
Right.
But it seems that that is an inherent problem or an inherent issue with food processing plants, where they are reusing the water. And if they don't reuse the water, let's see, what are they going to do with it? Well, they're going to have to run it through some kind of a very, I suppose, expensive and costly process for purification type of thing.
Then, Mr. Chair, like they said, wheat absorbs this and uses it. Does that cancel that out? Is that crop enough to cancel it out, or?
I think that's part of the purpose of what I refer to as cropping it,
mm-hmm.
With the right crops to use as much
nitrogen fixing.
Nitrogen, but there, I suppose, we're in, and I'm not a scientist in this area, but I suppose we're dealing with the quantity in and the quantity out, and whether the quantity out is sufficient to overcome the quantity in. Is that the kind of layman's fair way of describing it?
Yes, Chair Johnson, that is exactly it. It's basically a mass balance. The amount of nitrogen that you put on the ground has to be balanced by the amount that comes off. So the crop uptakes that nitrogen and uses it as a nutrient for growth. And that's what the food processors and even conventional agriculture, in theory, is striving to do, is put on the amount of nutrient that the crop needs. The crop takes it up. You remove the crop. You have to remove the crop, otherwise the plant just falls down there and decays, and the nitrogen still goes back into the soil.
In terms of the fertilizer on the big circles that you might have seen, or some of the big circles you might have seen back there, that's all very carefully monitored. And if you had noticed, there may be this kind of huge drum sitting there, which is fertilizer chemical that is being, that is being applied. And in most of those cases, it is extremely carefully monitored. I don't know whether, I don't want to say it's because we're worried about how much we put back in the earth, as they are the fact that they have to buy that stuff. Yeah. It goes in those big drums, and it's not cheap. And the higher you go up with the price of oil, the greater the cost of that stuff. So it's to their advantage to monitor it,
right,
in those cases very carefully, sort of thing. And therefore, it has good use. If I can, I get to a little other question, but you had a question.
Would you care to speculate on what brought the level down? You want to take a guess or prediction here?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, I hesitate to speculate because we haven't yet actually looked at that. I will tell you, probably go out on a limb here, and I'll give you my opinion of what the largest factor has been. And I believe that is the ability to store the wastewater so that they can have more flexibility in when they apply it.
Mm-hmm.
That combined with adding additional land so that they're not putting so much in a small area.
Thank you. That's something of a problem, isn't it, in the storing of the wastewater? That is, that you just can't go out here and put 100 million gallons of this in a you know, 2 acre hole someplace without running some risk that more of that's going to get down into the groundwater than you probably wanted.
Chair Jensen, that also is exactly right, and that's one of the dilemmas that the industry faces, is how to accomplish that. It's also extremely expensive to build large storage facilities. Some of them have put in very large storage facilities in order to be able to hold their wastewater for many weeks at a time.
I think in relationship, one of the producers there, one of the companies, she was required to put in some $12-15 million holding storage, and another one of the companies with perhaps a little larger production wasn't required to make the same kind of expenditure with the lining of the areas. Is that correct or incorrect?
Chair Jensen, it's sort of correct. What we do in our permit process is we limit the application of the wastewater so that and water itself, hydraulic loading as well. So we put limitations in the permit that they can't apply above certain loadings of both nitrogen and water. How they accomplish that is something that they figure out on what they want to do. Some decide to build storage facilities, some decide to manage in other ways, which again is largely scheduling and having enough land and enough flexibility to move it around as they need to.
There was one other thing, committee members, that I wanted to ask in relationship to this, and that in the last year and a half, there's been a substantial, what do you call them, notices of noncompliance or something of that nature. It's resulted in some a poor boy from the high country looked like pretty significant fines. Maybe for large companies they aren't, I don't know. But this was public reported in the local papers and various and sundry other places. I think fines in relationship to the one operation and maybe a couple of operations, I'm not sure. Is that and I guess in light of where you the testimony that you've given us and I'm not quarreling with the fines that have been given, only to make note that there have been some problems. Apparently there have been some problems by your own records on this and by the reporting of those records by the press. That at least would tend to indicate the department is kind of doing their job because they found the problems, but it also would kind of tend to indicate that maybe they slipped a little bit on it because they let the problems appear. Can you help me with that and an understanding of that a little bit?
Chair Jensen, I guess what I would say to that, I think I know what you're referring to in terms of the enforcement actions and the civil penalties that have happened in the last few years. That was a result of, I think, after the permits and the action plan came into place, the permits started being tightened up. There was more requirements on the management side of the wastewater than there had been in the past. There were many more reporting requirements for them to keep records and keep track of things. And I think there was a tendency, it was a learning curve, both for the food processors and for us. And some of that did get away from us. It got a little out of hand, and by the time we all got it figured out, there had been some pretty significant violations of some permit conditions.
I guess the thing the committee would probably be interested in is if in the judgment of the agency this issue has been resolved, because
I saw some reports where the nitrogen in some of the wells around there was up around 70 parts per million or billion, whatever, and that's about 10 times, I think, what the standard would be. And I understand that this is a fairly volatile area, or delicate area maybe is a better way to refer to it. And of course our hope would be that we're looking at a situation where we're going to bring those things back into compliance, or into, you know, a level where we're below the 7 parts. Is it billion or million?
Milligrams per liter would be parts per million.
Million, no.
Chair Jensen, I think, I mean, what you're speaking of is the exact intent of the groundwater management area, is to, you know, to bring all the parties together in order to come up with a set of actions that will address the nitrate loading. The trend analysis, I think it's important, and I know that Mitch said this, but I think it's important to recognize that the trend analysis and the food processors are one piece of the puzzle.
Yes, I know.
Out there. There are many, many, there are other sources as well that are including some past practices that which you know are not in place now, but that it will take some time in order for that to really sort of make its way through the system. So we have a lot of data from the food processors. We have less data in some of the other areas, and that's something that we're working with the committee, the local committee there, to improve, to get some additional data so that we can do a statistically legitimate trend analysis, and then also to continue doing the updates to the trend analysis from the food processing sources. So I think we continue to work with the local committee there.
I think our past practice or past experience even goes back to that infamous group that used to occupy some of that real estate that used that area as a place to blow up shells, and we got quite a bit of nitrates in the soil from the actions of the Umatilla Army Depot at one time, to a point that it was, what is the term that we have at the Portland Harbor now?
Oh, Superfund?
Yeah, Superfund, you know, designated area, which ostensibly it's been cleaned up, but what some of the leftover might be is another question. Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A fair amount of saltpeter goes into gunpowder. That's
yes.
True. The question I have is a little different one. In the meantime, while we're busy trying to figure out how to get this nitrate, the extra nitrates, out of the soil and out of the groundwater, by obviously either applying them in different ways or by applying less of them, are there ways of actually removing them from drinking water? And I'm asking this out of pure ignorance. I have no idea whether there are economic ways for a family that has a well out there to get those 70 parts per million out of their drinking water so that they're not affected by them.
Chair Jensen, Representative.
In the meantime,
Barnard, the answer is yes, there are ways to do that. And part of the efforts in the groundwater management area is to do public education and, first of all, just make sure people know of the risk, people that are on private wells, so they can get it tested. But there are treatment systems for residential use. There's reverse osmosis. There's some filters that will take out nitrate if that's the only concern. And there are many people in that area that have such systems installed in their homes. I can't tell you off the top of my head even if we know what percentage, yeah. But I certainly do know that many people out there have purchased those kinds of systems.
And a follow-up. If the primary sources of nitrates are identified in those areas, are they expected to help defer the cost of those treatment systems for families that otherwise would not need them but for the contamination?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beinhardt, I'm actually not sure if I know the answer to that question. I don't believe that the sources themselves have created any kind of financial assistance, but I would have to look into it to see if there is public assistance available.
Well, I wasn't asking about public assistance. I was asking about whether or not the people who put the materials in the groundwater are in some way liable for that to people who incur extra cost as a result. It's really a legal question, I guess.
Chair Jensen and Representative Bernhardt, I guess I would, at this point in time, I don't believe there's a program like that, that would be for groundwater, that would be sort of analogous to, I believe, the Superfund program, which is does have some liability requirements, the federal Superfund program. I don't think there's an analogous sort of situation. And again, here we are looking at a variety of sources, some of which are historical, and there's really just not a legal structure for that I can.
We're dependent on is still a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I have one question. Then I'm done.
That's all right.
These filtration systems, exactly how efficient are they? And when they're done filtering that water out, is there anything left in there, and what can get through? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Chair Johnson, Representative Schaffler, I cannot give you an answer completely off the top of my head. I can tell you that that these systems are very efficient at removing nitrate. Now, your question kind of implied other things.
Too bad nitrates don't prevent tooth decay. I'm getting that fluoride. That's my question. These systems do remove fluoride.
It would depend on the specific system you're talking about. Reverse osmosis is going to remove a whole lot of things, and I do not know the answer to that question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate the final introduction of fluoride into this discussion.
Went
all day without getting there, but, guess who came up to the party?
Yep, thank you for your time.
We're closed. Thank you very much.